So essentially, this was the these three reasons were amalgamated, I think. And also there is another reason, which is that empires often don't require a particular reason to do what they feel has to be done in order to assert their power and their strength. And I always recall during the Roman occupation of Britain, Tacitus writes that the Roman governor of Britain, Agricola, at one point looked at the map and pointed in the direction of Ireland and said, "What is this and who lives here?" So it was pointed out that some people lived there, of course very primitive tribes, and he said, "Yes, yes, but why aren't we there?" And it was pointed out to Agricola that it wasn't considered necessary to be there because these people had no intrinsic merit or value. And he said, "But that's not the point. The point is that if we have one area which is not occupied by us, it might give ideas to people here." and so Iraq was the one country, major country in that region, apart from Syria, which hadn't been brought totally under U.S. hegemony. And it was felt that given with the refusal of the Saudi regime, the stubborn refusal to tolerate the entry of American soft power, i.e. U.S. culture, you know, etc., etc., that it might be quite useful to have a country in the region which could be used as a model. This, I think, is where they'll come across. Because while the Quislings in Washington, Kenan Makia, Fuad Ajmi, and their friends went in to see Bush and warned him, and encouraged him and said, "You will be welcomed with sweets and flowers in every Iraqi city, and the Marines will be garlanded by our young women, just like they were when they liberated France after the Second World War." Whether the more serious elements in the administration actually believed this or not, I don't know, but certainly they got a shock when they arrived in the principal cities of Baghdad and found a sullen, passive, and angry population. And journalists reported that most people they spoke to said, "We didn't like Saddam, but we hate you, and get out as quickly as you can." And the Guardian reported not so long ago, Suzanne Goldenberg, their Jerusalem correspondent who speaks perfect Arabic and Hebrew, unlike most Western correspondents in Baghdad, actually reported that these pictures shown of young kids welcoming the Marines missed the point, because none of the journalists, other journalists, understood what the kids with their smiling faces said to the Marines. And she said, "The kids talk to each other, laugh, smile, then one goes up to a Marine and says in Arabic while smiling, 'We hate you, you motherfucker.'" I stress this to demonstrate that the basic gut response, the basic gut response of the Iraqi people is that they are not for the occupation. The initial remark that we have given the Shiite people of Iraq their freedom was greeted with the chants of "We hate America" and three big Shiite demonstrations. So now they are finding it difficult to know what to do in that country, because obviously Ahmed Chalabi and Kenan Makia, who hoped that they would be put in power very rapidly, are finding that this is not the case. Kenan Makia has now returned to his university at the United States to recover. Chalabi, I'm told, is still in locked, holed up in some U.S.-protected security building, waiting to come to power. But I think this is going to be very difficult. I don't think he is going to be put into power, and I think at the present time they're not totally sure what they are going to do. One thing they will not do is permit a free election. The notion of permitting free elections if you've actually conquered an oil-rich state is something they don't like. This goes a long way back. It predates the current round of imperial aggression. It goes right back to the first big regime change, which they organized in 1953 in Iran, where a democratic leader, Mohammad Mossadegh, was toppled because he nationalized the Anglo-Iranian oil company. That was, just to remind people, done by probably the most radical Labour government that Britain has had, with Herbert Morrison as Foreign Secretary, proclaiming that the Iranians were stupid, hysterical people and had absolutely no idea what they wanted, were arch intriguers, and just the abuse that was used to describe a whole people was quite amazing. And of course in the United States there was Truman in power. So you had an alliance between the British Labour Party, which was quite a radical program for the party, but not as far as imperialism was concerned. The process was begun by Labour and finished off by Churchill, who had defeated them in an election. But all the early phase, the big pressure on Attlee was to intervene. When Mossadegh first threatened to nationalise Anglo-Iranian oil, Attlee wanted Herbert Morrison wanted Attlee to send in British gunboats and actually invade Iran. This was vetoed by the United States at that stage because they thought that this would create a massive rebellion all over the region, and they were right. So regime change, occupations, etc., are not new. Now, what will be the consequences of this particular occupation and intervention? I think it will create, over the next two decades, further instability in that world, that the pro-US regimes in that region and Saudi Arabia, Egypt will be challenged. If the United States decides to embark on another adventure and try and knock out the Ba'ath Party in Syria, then they'll find that is not as easy as what they did in Iraq. And even in Iraq, I think one has to understand that basically the Ba'ath leadership decided not to defend Baghdad. That what Saddam had done this time, in sharp contrast to the Gulf War, is that he had basically given a lot of autonomy to regional commanders, both in the north and the south, and held command of the city of Baghdad himself with his Republican Guard. In my opinion, and I'm sure this will come out fairly soon, a big deal was done by the United States and the Ba'ath leadership and the Ba'ath military. Otherwise it doesn't make sense, because, you know, the first thing you do if you're going to defend Baghdad is knock out all the bridges. That automatically would have delayed the advance by another 2 weeks. And if Baghdad had decided to resist, it's as sprawling a city as LA, by the way, with millions of people, and if they decided to resist in every single quarter, they could have held the advance of the United States up by another at least a month, if not more, or compelled the Americans and the British to virtually destroy the city, which would have led horribly to enormous civilian casualties, but could possibly have brought down the Blair regime, because the one thing they were scared of was heavy civilian casualties. But the Ba'ath decided not to resist, despite the best efforts of the Iraqi information minister. One of the more pleasant discoveries of this war. But despite that, they decided not to resist, and I think they probably did a deal in which money exchanged hands and promises were made. And ultimately, I think that they probably will have to bring back large sections of the Ba'ath apparatus to run Iraq, just like the British used the Japanese to crush any uprisings and resistance in Vietnam and Indonesia immediately after the Second World War. They did it quite shamelessly, that yesterday's enemy became today's ally, because you knew these people were armed, had a knowledge of that particular country, and were used to crush the thing. And I think this is probably what they will do, but even that is going to be very messy, because it's not going to be easy for the, even with that apparatus, to crush the Shiites. So this new phase of extremely aggressive forward policy of the American Empire, which the Bush regime has adopted, I think has yet to be proved. I mean, we will see as to how effective it is. They were very shocked when they encountered 3 weeks of resistance. But, you know, if they decide to go into Syria or leave alone Iran, they will encounter much, much heavier resistance in those regions. What is absolutely undeniable today, and what makes the situation very unique, is, I think this is the first time in human history that we have a total domination of one empire of the world. You have never had a situation like that. And even in ancient times, where people might not have known it, in the Mediterranean empires which were being built, the Chinese Empire and the Chinese civilization was a very, very strong factor in the world. At the present time, we have a situation where the figure I like to give, which concentrates our minds, or should, is that with the United Nations membership standing now at 190 member states in the United Nations, in 120 of these states there is a US military presence. That you have now a network of US military bases all over the world. Now there will be a new one in Iraq, so we probably have to say 121. But this network of military bases is not designed for a joke or to waste money. It's designed to preserve and protect U.S. interests, U.S. hegemony in that region. This is something which the project for the American Century first came out with, which is now officially part of the Bush regime strategy doctrine, and they're pushing it through. Now, where will the opposition to this latest move come from? First, it will come, I think, from the regions which they've newly occupied, which is extremely important. Whether it will come from former imperialist states who are now feeling slightly twitchy is an open question. I mean, I just notice, you know, it's very good that the French and the Germans regretted the war, but concretely, they did nothing to stop. And that's, once the war had begun, the thing was this. This was also some of the opposition, sections of the official opposition in Britain. We don't want this war. It's wrong. It's unjustified. It's immoral. Even that word was used. But once the war began, Robin Cook, the senior British cabinet minister, said, now you can't oppose it anymore. The Germans called on the Iraqis not to resist at all, and the French wished them Godspeed. German military bases were used. French airspace was not denied, as had been in the past, and people just said, okay, now end it quickly. Now, you know, this is sort of completely unserious. In fact, the only elected assembly in Europe to try and stop the war was the Turkish parliament, which, against the advice of its generals, against the advice of its leaders, voted against the war. And stopped the, delayed the war by about 2 or 3 weeks and irritated the imperial leadership no end. But this is not the case. The Europeans talked a lot, but when it came down to concrete actions, they did absolutely nothing. And in my opinion, it would be an absolute disgrace if the United Nations now took charge of Iraq and cleaned it up. I'm completely opposed to that. I think the Americans and the British have occupied it. Let them clean out the mess. Let them see what it's like. It would be good education for the United States to see what it's like to control a country and run it totally against the will of its population. That's the why one has to refer to this new process as the recolonization of Iraq. In the old days, the British Empire could play the tribesmen and the tribal chiefs in the countryside against the opposition in the towns. It's very interesting. The Ottoman Empire prior to them used to stress, especially in the 19th century, the importance of the Iraqi towns and developing these towns against the tribesmen, who they regarded as pretty regressive, and they were right. The Ottomans were right on that. The British completely reversed the model, and when they occupied Iraq in the 20s, prevented the laws which existed in the towns of Iraq from being applied to the tribes, because they built the tribes as support for themselves. But that period is now long gone. You don't have tribes to that extent. The closest you come to it is Kurdistan, where a lot of money has exchanged hands continuously in order to win over tribal leaders. But in the rest of Iraq, this is no longer the case. And it's worth remembering also that in the resistance which took place to the British Empire in the 20s, the Shia and the Sunnis united against the British Empire. It was a pretty unified struggle which took place. So one, you know, while the Shias are the strong element, it's not impossible that in this case too, and this certainly has been proposed by many of the Sunni clerics who called for joint meetings in both Shia and Sunni mosques to protest the occupation, even as we speak. I think I'll stop.
Thanks very much, Kevin.